To talk with Art Bell, call the Wild Card line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It's like we've talked ourselves out of a show or something. I mean, we're at this point where we both sort of, with a wink and a nod, agree that our present course is not going to change. With that in mind, the future is so predictable that, I don't know, all you can say is, smell the roses. Or is there more? We'll find out in a moment. Peter Ward is a scientist. He's had some pretty rough words to say, to be sure. But I have come up, actually, with a couple of questions. I mean, I thought we almost sort of just ended the show, but we didn't really. Here's a question for you, Peter. You and I got to a pretty bleak point there. What do you think that our politicians know, and when do you think they knew it?
Well, that's a really interesting question that we in the scientific world are wondering about this current administration. And the reason that a number of us are a little worried is that the Bush administration has not bothered to really hire first-rate people for advice.
But what if they have? I mean, what if they're not already, in essence, accepting what it is you said tonight and concluded that we really can't do all that much about it, so why turn the economy upside down? Might as well keep the roses around to smell for as long as we can, since it's going to happen anyway.
Could be. I mean, that very well could be the point they're taking. They certainly took that point of view about drilling up in the Arctic. I think their point was they're realizing the gasoline prices are going to go through the roof, and
yes.
They finally said, we're going to get less flack over killing a lot of Arctic wildlife than we are about $3 a gallon gasoline. So there is certainly a cynical real politic that seems to have taken hold there.
Let me be fair here. I'm not sure that we killed very much Arctic wildlife with the Prudhoe Bay adventure. In fact, actually, the evidence is somewhat to the contrary, unless that's all oil company hoo-ha. But, I mean, you hear about the caribou mating near the warm, you know, pipeline and all the rest of this stuff, that the pipeline never hurt the hair on the head of anything.
Well, you do hear about the 20 million extra caribou, and I've seen all that wonderful propaganda.
Is that what it is, propaganda?
Well, again, the people I talk to up there say that near the pipeline, an awful lot of what has happened to that landscape is frightening compared to what it used to be its native state. And I guess it's really, do you appreciate wildlife and local ecosystems, or do you appreciate it when we go in and use them to our advantage? And it's a tough call.
It's a tough call. What about Anwar?
Well, that's the point that a lot of my people say should have been the line in the sand. I'm talked to a lot of the environmental community here because there is a lot of big money in Seattle. There's a lot of people that can afford to work on environmental causes. So there's a really large contingent here, which was pretty dismayed that happened. My own sense was that there's worse things that are going to happen. I kind of see that was almost an inevitable one. I'm a little more worried about what's going to happen to the Songus Forest in southeast Alaska. That's going to go under the axe for firewood that we don't really need, and that will have a much worse effect than drilling. I mean, the drilling can be environmentally careful. I have a lot of friends in the oil company, too, and so I think drilling Anwar's is not going to be as bad as what we do to, say, southeast Alaska.
God knows, we certainly need the oil until we get something else, and that brings me from the politicians, which I'm sure we'll come back to you. Why can't one of you guys, you scientists, come up with something that'll save our butts here? I mean, some great inhaler of unfriendly gases, or, you know, draining something that's going to hurt us otherwise, or do something with science that'll help us out of all of this a little bit?
Well, the best statistic I heard was sort of an incredible number, where I read that GM was making a $10,000 profit per SUV. This was the single largest bit of money that came into their inventory. As a bottom line thing, an SUV is like so marvelous. And once you've got that sort of economic driver, why worry about oil prices? Mm-hmm. People are still buying them.
Now, what I'm asking is, not that, but why can't you, as scientists, come up with something that will modify the environment, something that will affect in some positive way the environment? Why not look to science for some great solution?
Well, here's a homily about that before I get at that question.
All right.
I learned to my great interest the great difference between animals and bacteria. And it turns out that animals and all creatures that have a nucleus in their cell figured out evolutionarily a long time ago that when you've got an environment that's a problematical place, you build some new body part to deal with it. When you were a fish and you want to get on land, you build some lungs and some legs and this and that. Bacteria are so alien. What bacteria do when faced with an environment that they don't like, they change the environment. They don't change themselves. And they do this by creating and building chemicals. And they fuse these chemicals out of their cell walls until the environment has been so radically changed that there's no longer a problem.
So then why don't we act like bacteria and put you guys to work?
Well, I think we are acting like bacteria, actually. I think we are changing the environment so radically, but whether or not the majority of we humans can actually live in it as happy as the bacteria are, I think, is another point.
No, but Peter, I'm talking about this magic over-unity device that I'm promised by so many people. I'm still waiting for a toy to come wiggling through my door, even a toy. But something like that, something along the line of the Manhattan Project to investigate some alternative energy source that would save the world. How about that, Peter?
Well, it would certainly take leadership from the top. And I remember when the first administration of this Bush came into office, he was talking about hydrogen fuel cells.
Well, you're taking me back to politicians here. What I'm asking you is a hard science question. In other words, if the politicians were to set science loose and say, look, we've got a Manhattan spare no expense kind of project. We need a new energy source. Here's the money. Go find it. Is it possible?
Well, I don't think you actually need a new energy source. I think all the energy sources that we have around us are going to be sufficient. The first thing you would do is go back to nuclear energy and make it safe. If we brought in, I think, some really good 21st, 22nd century solutions to the reactor situation,
yeah,
you can shut down all the coal fire plants. An awful lot of my friends in industry think we have to do just that. We have to go nuclear. That's certainly an almost unlimited source of energy right off the bat there. It's much less dangerous if you can take care of the containment and can take care of the waste issues.
Aha, the waste issues, yes. There was just a story this last week that some scientist lied about Yucca Mountain, that place very adjacent to where I live, as a matter of fact.
I saw that. Well, I'm
did you about the possibility of all this getting into the water table? It seems like a very serious place to tell a lie.
It is. Well, the
very
going on at Hanford, we've got it right next to the Columbia River, and plutonium is moving into the water table there. So, I mean, that's no surprise that these are government scientists, of course, lying. Again, technology can handle these things. I think, especially putting this stuff in glass, really does look like it's going to be a potentially good solution.
It seems like it would be a good solution if there weren't people who wanted to do terrible things. That's such a gotcha.
Well, that is a gotcha.
And then we're talking about, what, tens of thousands of years of safe, unmolested storage, something like that.
Yeah, that's another big gotcha.
We can't even get past the next quarter, much less think about 10,000. We haven't done anything for 10,000 years.
Art, I think you have to be a little optimistic. I just suspect that in this particular case, if we really put our minds to it, but the point about putting minds to it, it takes a lot of dollars to put minds to things. And you were mentioning the Manhattan Project. Where in this political world, we're about to switch over to Social Security, That'll cost $2 trillion if we do this new system. Now, that's a lot of change. $2 trillion, if it were thrown at the energy problems, would certainly, I think, put us in a much better position than we're going to be.
Okay, well, that's what I was asking. In other words, with enough money and enough will and a let's go to the moon kind of attitude about it, could we come up, could science pull something out for us?
Yeah, I suspect so. I think that there's certainly that even the automobile industry, as you know, for years dealt with looking at new types of engines and always backed away simply because it was cheaper to keep the status quo. I mean, gas was always going to be regulated with government, so why build these really highly efficient engines? Toyota lost its shirt on hybrids, as did the other companies, and they're just not willing at this moment to go there. I mean, hybrid is a really simple technology. We've got that. We could double mileage right now, which is going to take a gigantic geopolitical problem of Mideast oil off the table to the extent that it is. So why don't we go there? So there's certainly economic reasons why that does not happen. $10,000 in SUV is the first one.
Yes. All right. What kind of event, Peter, do you imagine that might come along that would... I mean, we do things by, you know, because of crisis in this country. We don't move until there's some kind of a crisis. So what kind of crisis do you anticipate would change our minds all over the world about this? How big a deal would it have to be?
Well, strangely enough, just off the top of my mind, I almost hate to say this, is that if terrorists put a nuke into one of the harbors, I think that would change our mind about energy policy.
How so?
I just suspect that the trauma coming out of that, where you say you lose tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Americans, would cause such a national rethinking about what we're doing and how things are done that I think there would be this huge cathartic change in an awful lot of things. Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
Well, let's hope it doesn't. That's certainly one of the things threatened right now, and you can be absolutely sure that if those who want us dead could get their hands on one of these things, that's if they would use it that way or in some equally dramatic, traumatic way. No question about it, right?
Yeah, well, I suspect that they would if they could get it, and to me, that's the greatest single fear. We live where I live in Seattle, it's a port town. We have these containers coming
sure.
in all the time.
All the time.
And this is a target. We know they already tried to blow up the Space Needle. This was about 5 or 6 years ago, and these people are nuts.
Well, then let's look at proliferation for a moment, Peter. Is that something you know anything at all about? We're pressuring...
Proliferation? I just know what I read, which is just probably the same stuff you do.
Uh-huh. We're pressuring North Korea right now to give it up. It doesn't seem likely they're going to do so. Iran is working very hard on a nuclear weapon. I don't know what stage they are, and who knows what other countries are doing it. Inevitable, almost?
I don't think so. I don't think it has to be inevitable, but I think, again, the keystone of so much of our ills right now is this dependence upon foreign oil. And once again, I think if you get your own box in order, energy-wise, and again, I think this really deals with a lot of alternative ways of fueling our cars, because our cars that eat up most of our oil, we can actually pursue Middle East policies radically differently. I don't quite yet understand why Bush or whoever is in office hasn't made it the single greatest energy policy as national security. You know, Carter said it was the moral equivalent of war when we had the last energy, and the American people just laughed at him. But I think that really has to be the point now. It is, in a sense. It is the ills that face us are energy related.
Well, they are. I remember the last gas crisis. I went through that, and it was a little hiccup compared to what could happen. Well, we are, how dependent on foreign oil are we now?
Oh, hugely. About half of the oil that's coming into my neck of the woods, at least, is Mideast oil.
Half.
So it's probably in some areas even more. It's a gigantic problem, and I think it pushes all of the foreign policy aspects about the Middle East are just
including the Iraq war.
Well, including Iraq war, including how we deal with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, including how we deal with Tehran, including how we deal with Saudi Arabia. Our entire viewpoint is sort of immersed in the fact that that is the world center of oil.
All right, if we agree that oil is shaping our foreign policy, which is not then necessarily always the most, what would be the right word, ethical course to take. I mean, it probably makes us bend and do things we wouldn't otherwise do. If it's that scale and that big, then why aren't we doing these things, cutting back, using, automobiles that get twice or three times the gas mile, all the things that you say we could be doing? Why do you think we're not? You think, why?
There's somewhere on the line some bottom line company is making a profit for us not to do that. All that foreign oil is going through companies which make a whole lot of money selling foreign oil. Selling giant SUVs makes General Motors and a lot of other companies a hell of a lot of money. Shareholders demand that the stock market keep going up a few percent every year. We all say, well, that's how we're going to make our money, the stock market. How do you think that happens? It's called profits. So that's, I'm sounding like an old communist here, and I'm way out of my field. But it sure makes common sense to me that were there an economic motive, it would change quickly.
Huh. What sort of event do you think would have to occur to change all the minds, including the politicians, virtually everybody screaming at once? Because right now, as long as it's here, it seems as though Americans, as long as they can get their gas, I mean, they're cool. So how big a crisis does it have to be? $3 a gallon, $5 a gallon, $10 a gallon? Where does it all break apart, Peter?
Well, my sense is the event, we keep talking about an event, and let's go back to...
Well, that would be an event.
Well, that could be an event, but I think a much bigger event is going to be climatically driven. And if I sound like I'm a broken record...
No, that's all right.
It all comes back to that. And I think the event that is going to really finally have to wake everybody up will be American agricultural production dropping drastically. In spite of everything else, we're still the major powerhouse for agriculture. Everybody eats. And if we start having a huge drop in farm productivity, and this could easily be spurred by, let's continue the drought system we have now and lock it in permanently, and let's make the entire Midwest, which is our richest grain belt, let's just dry it out as we did in the Dust Bowl years. Then we certainly didn't have any sort of policies that could stop all that erosion from taking place. Now we're in much better shape. But let's face it, if you stop rainfall to the middle part of the United States,
yes,
and stop it for 10 years,
yes,
you have created an event.
Yes, all right. That sure would be one.
And that would do it.
Take me back to the Dust Bowl. You mentioned the Dust Bowl, and I've never really exactly understood the dynamics of what caused the Dust Bowl. Do you, Peter?
Well, in a sense, I do. I followed the UN report on topsoils, and since about 1950 now, about one quarter of the topsoil in the agricultural regions of the world has been lost. But when you look where it has been lost, and of course that's what the Dust Bowl was, this was simply all the topsoil blown away, it almost always goes back to sort of a very primitive cut-and-run agriculture. And
so it was man that did this, and
yeah,
not a climate change?
No, it was really crappy agricultural practices in those days. We probably had a year or two of drought, but it was mainly the way they were farming was very ineffectually and very inefficiently. And now we have systems, as I understand it, where you farm contours, you work the contours, and there's a whole lot of ways that you can keep soil in place.
That is certainly interesting. I always, for whatever reason, assumed that the Dust Bowl was a climate event. No?
No, it doesn't seem to be.
Oh, well, that's amazing.
Far more related, I think, to just really crappy... Well, you know what we did is we opened up the Midwest and those regions. Everybody got 40 acres and a mule, and they were finding back in those days that a 40-acre farm would actually work, and that we always bemoan the loss of the mom-and-pop American farm. Well, those people didn't know how to farm. And you had just really poor practices, and it led to a whole lot of soil erosion.
Well, I just certainly learned something. I seem to recall in the Dust Bowl the people wishing, praying, dancing for rain, as though there had not been rain in a very great amount of time. I mean, it's certainly portrayed in the media.
Well, yeah,
as a climate event of some sort, that there just was no rain. Peter, hold it right there. I mean, I'm learning something this night. How about the rest of you? Did you know that the Great Dust Bowl event was not a climate thing? I certainly didn't. I always thought that was exactly what it was. Not poor mom and pop farming. This is the first time I've ever heard anything like that. But then again, that's what this program is for. Learning things you didn't know. Peter Ward is my guest. I'm Art Bell.
Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
I watch them grow. They learn much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Yeah, me too. Sometimes this piece of bumper music is just the right thing at just the right time. My guest is Peter Ward, and he'll be right back. Peter Ward, my guest, has a brand new book. It's called Gorgon. Oh, there is a title for you. Gorgon. And you ought to see the monster that is depicted right below. Oh, well, it seems like the moon's up there. Where's that Earth? No, I think it's the moon. And then there's this horrible monster. Horrible monster. It says Gorgon. The monsters that ruled the planet before dinosaurs and how they died in the greatest catastrophe in Earth's history. And that's your new book, right?
It's a mouthful, isn't it? Yes, it is.
Yeah, but that's still cool. I mean, that's a horrible-looking monster there.
Pretty cool beast, though. If you like dinosaurs, this
well,
is
yeah,
cooler.
If you like them. Who came up with that?
The Gorgon term or that subtitle?
No, the monster.
Well, evolution came up with it.
Well, yeah, all right. So I meant as an idea for the front of your book, Peter.
Well, they are, because they were the biggest victims, they were the T-Rex of that time. They were the coolest animals, so why not that title?
Yeah, why not? All right, so this is, though, before the dinosaurs, right? And how they died.
Yeah, well, this is your ancestor on the cover of that book. These are mammal-like reptiles.
Don't speak for me. Maybe yours.
The dirty little secret, of course, was there was an age of mammals before there was an age of dinosaurs.
Mm.
We've just been teaching people the wrong sort of history in school. And this really...
I don't feel any kinship at all with that.
Well, come on.
None.
big teeth, nice great big eye sockets, big brain. That's us.
I don't know about
that. You know, it's a Ralph Steadman cartoon.
I thought they had little pea-sized brains.
Nah, well, I mean, compared to those things around them. But don't forget, this is pre-dinosaurs, so they had the world, and this global warming extinction wipes them out. Mm. And that's why there was an Asia dinosaur. See, it was all a big mistake.
Hmm. All a big mistake, but then corrected by a big rock.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the bottom line, all right. Big rock comes along and things get put back on the normal track.
That's right.
Leading to us.
Uh-huh. All right, so they were killed. They were sent on their way by global warming, right?
CO2 did them in.
CO2 did them in. I guess the really important thing we're discussing this morning is how much of this is us and how much is going to happen anyhow.
Yeah, that's the hard part. As you know, that's where models just break down. And
yeah,
we're going to have to go through it and actually see. But can we take the chance? You know, that's the point. We could go to all this and reduce emissions, and we have all this climate change anyway. On the other hand, maybe we find out, gee, if only we'd done a little bit more, we could have saved it. So do you take the chance? I mean, that's the bottom line for me.
Well, ugly as this sucker is, he wasn't driving an SUV. That's for darn sure.
No. It was just bad luck that half of Russia turned into volcanic terrain.
Hmm. So, I don't know. I look at, for example, our president. He's an easy target, right? I don't know. If the president knows all you think you know, Peter, maybe he's made such not such a illogical decision. Perhaps weighing disrupting the economy and turning everything upside down against an unanswered question. And even you admit you really can't answer it about how much effect we are having. They opt not to turn the world upside down on a maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's the kind of decision you'd have to come to, Peter.
I don't think I come to that decision. This is, by the way, the same president and the same party who believes that evolution should be outlawed from being taught in schools. Now, I mean, explain to me the logic behind that little move. When you move away from fact and logic and knowledge, I think you're moving back towards the Dark Age. And you just go back to what was the Dark Ages. That was why it was a Dark Ages, because people like our president just didn't consult their scholars.
Well, not teaching evolution is just stupid.
Yeah, well, we just elected a senator in South Dakota who went in on a plank of not teaching evolution. That's a senator.
Hmm.
He overcame the speaker, or the head of the Senate, Dashley, was taken out by John Thune, who says that evolution never took place.
Yeah, that's pretty frightening.
It is frightening.
I agree with you. That's pretty frightening. It really kind of argues against anything going to get done. Well, doesn't matter. I'm going to get raptured anyway.
There we go. I'm going to get left behind myself. And those guys are selling a few books, aren't they?
Boy, I got some emails on that one, I'll tell you. That's my wife in the other room laughing. where are we with all this? I mean, you know, we're at this impasse where I guess we both know what's happening, and we both know that nothing realistically is going to get done. So it's an impasse.
But we could talk about the good news.
I'm all for that. Let's hear the good news.
The good news is we're living on a much safer planet than we had considered previously. The good news is the rate at which rocks from space are falling down on us is much lower than we had worried about 10 years ago.
Huh.
But the bad news is that a number of us who study rocks from space falling on the planet as a danger are trying to get a conduit to politicians. And here's why. In 1908, as you know, there was a big event in Siberia around the place called Tunguska, and this was a 50-meter-wide meteor which exploded in the atmosphere and knocked down a huge amount of forest around there. It's called the Tunguska event.
Right.
We now know it was caused by, again, a small asteroid, a big meteor, whatever you want to call it. it was an airburst, and the airburst had enough energy to be equivalent to several Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs. Now, we can expect things that size to hit the atmosphere about once every 100 years, and since that was about 100 years ago, all things being equal, we should expect another such event. Had that airburst happened over a big city,
yes,
there would have been the equivalent of dropping a large nuclear weapon on a large city. So my point being is that a number of scientists want a conduit to the White House or to Whitehall or to any place where there's a seat in government to quickly tell them that this was not a nuclear attack.
I hear you. If Denver is suddenly vaporized.
Totally. And so the next morning, Tehran's gone. And somebody says, George, I'm sorry, there was no radiation.
Well, look, if it was Tehran that was vaporized, I absolutely guarantee you that George Bush would be blamed, and it would not matter if it was a rock from space.
Yep.
George Bush would be blamed.
Well, the point is, if New York City was vaporized, we would immediately start looking at somebody to shoot at, immediately. And I mean, at what point can you get to the president in such a crisis and say, hey, look, on line six, there's this pointy-headed professor who's trying to tell you that it was an
airborne
asteroid.
Yeah.
People are seriously trying to get the government's attention to get a conduit in because of this.
Is there truly none now? I mean, if one of our cities vaporized, is there no level-headed person that would imagine it might be something other? I mean, after all, we wouldn't have it. We've got satellites looking for stuff in boost phase, right, from any logical place where they could be launched, in Russia and China and wherever. You know, we have this looking shield, don't we? And we could say, well, we didn't see anything in the boost phase, so
would think they missed it. I mean, we know that there's huge holes in this whole thing. There would be an immediate DEFCON, whatever it is. All the missiles would be put on alert.
Be DEFCON 1.
Yeah, if you have, say it's the worst-case scenario, New York City now is gone. 10 million people are killed by this airburst. Somebody's going to pay, right? Who are you going to shoot at? You got to shoot at somebody. So this is the scary scenario that is facing a lot of people who study extinction and impact.
So you are telling me, though, that there is presently no... That NORAD or you know, somebody would not phone the president and say...
NORAD wouldn't know. There's probably 50 scientists on the planet who would know. But right off the bat, with all the...
All right, let's back up. What are the odds that if something of substantial size was headed toward us, God, I'd love a clear answer to this question, that we would know beforehand? What are the odds we'd know beforehand?
Depends on the size.
All right. A size that would destroy a city.
You wouldn't see it.
50
meters coming at that speed, there's just no way. There's not enough people out looking for 50-meter stuff out beyond the Earth's atmosphere. It would come in, it would do its job, it'd be over, and no one would know what happened.
We'd never see it coming.
All of a sudden, you wake up, and you have this destroyed city. What do you do?
Because you don't know who sent this, I'm trying to imagine that actually occurring. Because you don't know who fired the missile that you suspect, you couldn't just willy-nilly dispatch a couple of ICBMs and destroy some of your most unfavorite people, or could you?
Or could you? The pressure was certainly on to do something. If you're a leader who has to show decisiveness, We've been attacked. I mean, that's what it would be. Do something quickly. Certainly the military would go to full-scale alert, and then you always have a greater problem than a further accident. You know, there's going to be provocation. Somebody does something. And so it is a dangerous scenario, and it is a totally natural scenario.
Huh.
So in some ways, again, I'm telling you, the world is much less dangerous than we thought. But because of these small things, at least to extinction or invisible, the world is almost a much more dangerous as we start learning the frequency by which this sort of event takes place.
I don't know, Peter. Even your supposed good news is somewhat apocalyptic.
Well, it would be boring if it were, wouldn't it?
I suppose.
I mean, you didn't bring me on the show to talk about the evolution of my favorite fossil species.
No, that's so. Right. No, I do want to know whether we'd see it coming. I mean, even a lot of times with the bigger stuff, I've told you this before. We get a sort of a thing in the news that says something typically like, Earth had a close encounter last Wednesday. Well, hey, last Wednesday. I never saw any story that said, hey, guess what? Earth's about to have a close encounter.
Well, there have been a number of those stories, and they've always turned out to be false.
Well, they had a couple where they said, look, it might be a, you know, coming right at us type deal, and then two or three days later, they changed it.
Exactly.
These, I assume, are big objects, right?
Yes, they are big objects. No, this size, this class stuff is invisible, and it is, I guess, the worst-case scenario. On the other hand, it's a big planet. Most of it's ocean, so the greatest chance is that it's not going to be over city. That chance is really tiny. But as we populate the Earth more and more, the chance is there.
Well, yes, but see, there's this other thing to worry about in that case. Sure, I mean, you're right. There's more water than there is land, so there's more of a chance it would hit water. However, something that would destroy a city, seems to me, when it hit the water, would tend to probably displace a lot of water, right?
Yeah, I don't know if airburst would cause a tsunami or not. That's certainly when one hits it causes a tsunami, but airburst is a pressure phenomenon.
Well, no, I'm thinking of one actually hitting.
Yeah, it's got to be bigger than 50 meters, and the chances are you've got a much better chance of seeing something like that coming in. But the scary class are the 50-meter because there's a lot more of them, and they are invisible.
Well,
I'll have to ask what they do to water art. I've never thought of that.
Probably nothing good. I mean, anything hitting that hard is going to displace a lot of water. We just had an experience with a tsunami. Pretty bad one.
The thing about the 50-meter things is they never hit the ground. I mean, they totally disintegrate in the atmosphere. They come down, and the reason there is an airburst, they compress the air. They're just not big enough to make it to the ground, so they...
Well, even assuming an airburst over water...
Yeah, there's going to be a pressure wave of some sort, you're right.
A good job, perhaps, for a model, considering we model everything else, so why not model an airburst over water? It's more likely than land.
Yeah, I could find that out, actually, about 2 days. I'll get back to you.
Really?
I'll send you an email. That one's easy to figure out.
I'd absolutely love that. How frequently do these size things pass by and make close calls?
Well, since we never see them, we don't know.
Oh, we never see them coming or going?
No, not the 50-meter size things. But we can model. We have this rough model that once a century, they hit the planet, the 50 meters, and cause this kind of boom. Again, Siberia was the unlucky victim last time. It took them many, many years to figure out what that was. I even read a science fiction book that said we ran into a black hole. A guy named David Brin, that was pretty idiotic, but he sold a lot of books.
You know these big ones where we had that few days scare?
Yep.
Let's say it hadn't worked out the way it did, and the scientists dismissed it and said, oh no, it's going to miss. Well, suppose that object they were talking about instead actually was on a course for Earth and did hit Earth. What would have happened? What was it? I remember it was a mile and something in size, right?
Yep. Well, we probably would have lost about 5 to 10% of all species on the planet. We have pretty good models for size of asteroid versus the effects on it. So it wouldn't be anything like a dinosaur killer, too small for that, but it certainly would be big enough to, I would say, disrupt agriculture and probably take out human civilization, be my guess.
Take out human civilization.
Yeah, the climate effects would be sufficient probably to stop farming for a while.
All right. How long a time, I'm trying to remember back to that news story, how long a time, if it had been headed at Earth, would we have had? How many years?
I don't think it's years. I think
months?
Most of these things are months or less.
Oh, months or less. All right. I would assume that humanity would, like in the movies, gather together all of its resources, whatever they might be, the attempt to put rockets on it and move its orbit or blow it to smithereens or, you know, we try everything we could. What's the current thinking in scientific circles, Peter, about what we could do as a, you know, a desperate measure?
Well, the two movies you saw actually came right out of a conference that I was lucky enough to be at. In 1995, we had a conference asking that question, and Spielberg had a representative there. The movie Deep Impact and Armageddon were both result of that, of the 3 days.
I'll be darned.
I was lucky enough, actually, to meet Edward Teller, who is the father of the hydrogen bomb, and have lunch with him. He was the perfect doppelganger, the double of Bela Lugosi. He looked like him, he sounded like him, and he was as scary as Bela Lugosi. And he was there because it was his point that a hydrogen bomb could deflect one of these. But it was really interesting because Los Alamos at that time, because we were just going out of the Cold War, had redirected the scientists to look for a new threat. In other words, you know, justify your own existence. And the one they looked for were asteroids and meteors. And so they put together a lot of interesting studies. And one of the most interesting and bizarre, they did an insurance investigation on looking at the risk to the infrastructure from meteor impact. And they had all the various risk factors, including the number of millions of people killed.
Mm.
And they came up to the conclusion that there was less risk of asteroid impact than there was, I think, they had it prorated over hundreds of years. And so it came out to you had less risk of dying from an asteroid impact than from being hit by lightning. But the fact that all the deaths happened in 1 year, and they looked at it over sort of 1,000-year timescales, didn't make me feel any happier about this.
Well, did they conclude that a nuclear device could explode it on the surface, or what, bored in as they did in the movie, or how would it be done?
Yeah, you
could, did they conclude it could be done?
You just you explode it as it's going by. I mean, this whole idea of landing on the surface and doing all that crap, that's such nonsense. I can't.
Nonsense. That's
nonsense.
All right. So instead you explode it very close by?
Yeah, and that's just going to give it a nudge. And don't forget that these things, all you have to do is just have a very slight course change.
Mm-hmm.
Given the distances, it would still have to go, because you want to get it when it's some ways away, it's going to miss the Earth.
So they concluded it could be done.
Oh, sure.
What about the downside that some people have talked about, that you smash it into many pieces that then become even more deadly for the planet than the original size monster?
Yeah, that's nonsense. They're not going to move
nonsense.
It'll all miss you, so that's what you want to do.
All right. Stay right there, Peter. Yes, we are going to go to the phones when we get back with Peter Ward. Sometimes it's such a joy picking bumper music from the high desert. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.